Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for October 2016. They include research on preventing firearm-related suicide. We'll also present treatment guidelines for adult attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and look at the long-term effects of supported employment for people with psychiatric disabilities. Two articles focus on psychotic symptoms, how to predict the risk of psychosis in individuals with prodromal symptoms, and how often psychotic experiences precede mental disorders as well as vice versa. And a 30-year follow-up study looks at long-term outcomes for the offspring of depressed parents. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the highlights with research on preventing suicide by firearms. Means restriction is a major method for reducing suicide rates. A suicidal crisis is often transient, so restricting access to more lethal means could allow the crisis to pass, or it could result in an attempt with a less lethal method. John Mann and Christina Michelle examine the relationship between the rates of firearm ownership and firearm suicide, and they report on the effectiveness of policy-based strategies for preventing firearm suicides. Greater firearm availability is associated with higher rates of suicide by firearms, and the risk of firearm suicide is greater in households with a gun. A locked gun closet, keeping guns unloaded, and locking ammunition or storing it in a different part of the house, each reduces the risk of suicide by over 50%. Studies outside the U.S. have examined the effect of altering firearm availability and ownership. Reducing availability has lowered both firearm suicide rates and overall suicide rates, but only where firearm suicides are prevalent. Similar gun control efforts aren't possible in the United States, so other methods to reduce firearm suicide rates have been explored. California and Indiana allow gun violence restraining orders, similar to those for preventing domestic violence. Only modest numbers of firearms have been seized by this method, however. Individual states have a variety of restrictions. Recent studies indicate that lower firearm suicide rates are linked to the requirement of a permit, waiting periods, safe storage, background checks, and registration guidelines. Non-legislative strategies have also been proposed. One approach uses education-based collaboration with family members of suicidal individuals, gun safety groups, and firearm dealers. For example, physicians could counsel families about means restriction, but one study found that only a quarter of the families of depressed adolescents heeded the clinician's recommendation to remove firearms from the household. New Hampshire began a suicide prevention campaign involving gun shop owners. They learned to recognize suicidal customers and, instead of selling them a gun, would encourage the customers to seek help. Roughly half of the retailers approached agreed to participate in the program after learning that suicidal intent is often short-lived. However, these programs seem to have a limited effect, since most firearm suicide involve guns bought years earlier. Another approach is firearm personalization, also known as smart gun technology. It limits firearms access to the owner or permitted users. This approach has met with a lot of resistance. The one gun of this type that's currently on the U.S. market is sold only through the manufacturer's website. No gun stores have agreed to carry it. Our treatment in psychiatry article is about attention deficit disorder in adults. Only a minority of adults with ADHD receive appropriate therapy. There are two major reasons. First, most clinicians don't diagnose ADHD properly. Second, they're apprehensive about possible malingering and afraid that the medications will be abused or misused. James McGuff addresses these roadblocks to treatment. Among psychiatrists, the greatest obstacle to diagnosis is failure to differentiate ADHD from other conditions. Many ADHD symptoms are nonspecific. Also, adult patients more commonly raise complaints related to perceived depression or anxiety. Identification of ADHD is improved by incorporating routine screening into assessments. A second barrier to appropriate treatment is concern that individuals are faking or exaggerating ADHD symptoms to obtain prescription medications or accommodations in academic or work settings. Clinicians should be wary of adults complaining of unusually extreme ADHD symptoms if they lack a childhood diagnosis and corroboration by a third party. Evidence-based treatments for adult ADHD include medication and various forms of cognitive behavioral therapy. Common medications that are approved by the FDA for ADHD in adults include extended-release stimulants and the non-stimulant atomoxetine. Some other medications are approved in children and are used off-label in adults, such as the extended-release alpha-2 agonists. Other agents with catecholaminergic activity, such as bupropion, modafinil, and tricyclic antidepressants, have various levels of established efficacy. These are preferred by some clinicians who are reluctant to prescribe stimulants. For stimulants, extended release and prodrug formulations may be preferred for single daily dosing, increased adherence, and decreased risk of abuse and misuse. After failure of two stimulant trials, or if stimulants are contraindicated, treatment with atomoxetine is generally the next step. Compared with stimulants, response to atomoxetine is more gradual. If anxiety continues, an SSRI can be safely added. An alternative is atomoxetine monotherapy, since it's been shown to reduce both ADHD and anxiety, although it's not approved for anxiety. With comorbid depression, clinicians must determine which disorder is more impairing. Antidepressant monotherapy is preferred with moderate to severe depression. This can be followed with stimulant augmentation if necessary. Some clinicians treat ADHD and comorbid depression with bupropion. It has demonstrated efficacy for both conditions, but isn't approved for ADHD. There are particular concerns about treatment of ADHD with co-occurring substance use. Non-stimulant treatments are alternatives to stimulants, but research indicates that ADHD medications used concurrently with recreational drugs neither worsen nor improve the underlying substance use disorder. For groups at highest risk of medication diversion and misuse, clinicians should consider extended release or prodrug stimulants or non-stimulants. It's essential to keep good records and insist on regular clinic follow-up visits. Our next study devised a process for predicting which patients will convert from prodromal psychotic symptoms to actual psychotic illness. Risk calculators have been developed for cardiovascular disease, cancer, and other somatic conditions. Tyrone Cannon and colleagues developed a similar model for psychosis. The study participants met criteria for clinical high risk according to the structured interview for prodromal syndromes. They were followed up for as long as 2 years until conversion to psychosis or their last contact. In the choice of possible predictors, the focus was on demographic, clinical, neurocognitive, and functioning measures that are easily administered in general clinical settings. The selection was based on empirical links to psychosis prediction in two or more prior studies of clinical high-risk cases. Over 2 years, the probability of conversion to psychosis was 16%. The variables that contributed to the risk for psychosis were higher levels of unusual thought content and suspiciousness, greater decline in social functioning, lower verbal learning and memory performance, slower processing speed, and younger age at baseline. Variables that were not significant predictors included stressful life events, trauma, and family history of schizophrenia. The model was validated in an independent data set, which is reported in a separate article by Ricardo Carrion and colleagues. However, the risk calculator isn't suitable for widespread clinical use. It can be validly applied only to patients who screen positive on the structured interview for prodromal syndromes. This requires training to administer. The most immediate uses of the risk calculator will be in research on psychosis risk factors and in research-driven clinical prevention trials. The timing of psychotic experience was examined by John McGrath and colleagues. They considered temporal associations between psychotic experiences and mental disorders. The data were collected as part of the World Health Organization's mental health surveys. They included more than 30,000 people from 18 countries around the world. Lifetime prevalence and age at onset of 21 common DSM-IV disorders were evaluated. Participants with psychotic experiences were at increased risk of a subsequent onset of 8 mental disorders compared with other people in the population. The diagnoses associated with temporally primary psychotic experiences were major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, social phobia, PTSD, adult separation anxiety disorder, bulimia nervosa, and alcohol abuse. On the other hand, nearly all of the disorders examined were associated with subsequent onset of psychotic experiences. Thus, for several diagnoses, the temporal relationship was bidirectional. The next study was about supported employment for people with schizophrenia and other severe mental illnesses. There's ample research showing that evidence-based supported employment services substantially improve employment outcomes for people with psychiatric disabilities. However, these studies have typically followed subjects for only 6 to 18 months. Judith Cook and colleagues looked at data covering 13 years. They gathered information on participants in a federally funded study of supported employment programs for people with severe mental illnesses. The participants were randomly assigned to two conditions. The control condition was either usual services alone or usual services plus vocational rehabilitation. The experimental condition consisted of evidence-based supported employment services delivered by employment specialists on multidisciplinary teams that coordinated employment and clinical services. The goal was placement in competitive jobs that met the patient's career preferences. Over the 13-year follow-up, the study examined the participants' earnings and their receipt of supplemental security income or Social Security disability insurance. Overall, the outcomes were modest. About a third of the participants had any earned income during this period. Only 13% ever worked enough to forego disability cash payments. However, the recipients of the supported employment program were almost 3 times as likely as the control subjects to be employed. The participants in the supported employment program also had significantly higher earnings than the control subjects, and they were more likely to achieve suspension of disability payments, but the amount of earnings was small. In general, worse long-term work outcomes were found for older participants and those with histories of substance abuse. Program beneficiaries with schizophrenia spectrum disorders were more likely to work compared to those with other diagnoses, but they were less likely to reach non-beneficiary status. Over time, the effect of supported employment diminished. By the end of follow-up, it was completely attenuated. Nonetheless, the model is more cost-effective than other vocational rehabilitation programs, and it results in beneficial social and personal outcomes. Our final article reports on another long-term follow-up. This one looked at a variety of outcomes in the offspring of depressed parents. It's widely known that individuals with depressed parents have an increased risk of psychopathology themselves. What isn't known is the long-term consequences through the full age of risk. Myrna Weissman and colleagues present a 30-year follow-up of biological offspring of depressed parents and compare them with the offspring of non-depressed parents. The depressed parents had moderate to severe illness and were selected from outpatient settings for the pharmacologic treatment of mood disorders. Non-depressed probands were selected at the same time from an epidemiologic sample of adults from the same community. They had no lifetime history of psychiatric illness. The offspring were interviewed several times over the follow-up period. Their mean age at the last interview was 47 years. Diagnostic evaluations were conducted blind to the parents' clinical status. Over the follow-up period, the risk for major depression was approximately 3 times as high in the high-risk offspring, the children of the depressed parents. For both offspring groups, the highest risk for the first onset was between the ages of 15 and 25. Prepubertal onsets were uncommon, but the high-risk offspring had a more than tenfold greater risk. The higher rate of major depression in the high-risk group was largely accounted for by the early onsets, but later recurrences in the high-risk group were also increased. The high-risk offspring also had a higher rate of phobia. The high-risk offspring received more treatment for emotional problems and had worse overall functioning. They also had more divorces and fewer children. Their mortality rate during this period was also higher. This was due to deaths from unnatural causes, mostly among men. There was a big difference in the mean age at death, 39 years compared with 47 years. This concludes our audio highlights of the October issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include perinatal substance abuse, using neuroscience to understand fear and anxiety, suicide attempt as a risk factor for completed suicide, ECT in geriatric depression, and a clinical tool to estimate risk of depression relapse. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.